And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
It's the most wonderful time of the year. You are screaming in pain because I'm eating your brain, and you've pissed on yourself out of fear. It's the most wonderful time of the year. Oh, yes. Yes, happy holidays, Zoms. I'm the Chris Keeper, and it's that most wonderful season, Halloween. I'm down here doing some charity work at the zombie nursery, singing to the little baby zombies. What? How do zombies have babies? Well, I can tell you for a fact that you do not want to know. Anyway, you know what time of year this is, and you know what it means. Short stories! We have a horrifying Halloween story from every one of the crew this year. And now we have four people, so now we have... Hey, yes, four stories, you moron. Without any further ado, here's the hair metal hero story. A bit of an appetizer, I should say, before the main courses. I'm just glad that this story is about his brain, and not his large intestine.
Blocked. God damn right is blocked. I hate this shit. My editor's gonna kill me if I don't get this piece done on time. Just write, he says. You're good at it. Officious little prick. Not like he knows what it is to write. Who gets to be an editor without ever having written anything? Cocksuckers, that too. Just a short story, he says. Some little zinger. He can take his little zinger and shove it. Use a computer, he says. It's easier. Wrong! That's not writing, I tell him. Writing is done as writing, you know, with a fucking pen, on paper, like since the creation of papyrus. Ditch the typewriter, he says. It's a waste of time and money. Wrong again, pal. It's in every click-clack of those keys and every carriage return that something takes shape. So what if I spend a fortune on ribbon that ain't made anymore, and I should have a share of the whiteout fortune? It's my damn business, literally. It's my livelihood. Let me do it my way. Still, there's nothing there. No spark. Nothing even handwritten yet. No notes, no outline, nothing. It's frustrating. Want to eat? Gotta write. Want to pay the electric bill? Gotta write. Christ. It's times like this I wish I was Robert E. Howard, with the specter of Conan behind me letting me know I would die at his hand if I didn't tell his stories. What a terrible and horrible privilege that must have been. But hey, this is real life here, and I'm not crazy. I've always made my deadlines. That's just the way it is with me. Hunker down with a gallon of Diet Pepsi and a bag of peanut M&Ms and just fucking crush it. God, still nothing there. I've got my soda and my candy, a box of pens, and the typewriter is ready. I've been like this for a week. What else can I do?
Get rid of the blockage,
a voice says in the back of my mind. No shit, I tell myself.
Get rid of the blockage.
Yeah, I get it. Get rid of the blockage. Fucking hell.
Get rid of the blockage.
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 Jesus,
what do you want me to do?
Get rid of the blockage.
Get rid of the blockage.
Get rid of the blockage. Get rid of the blockage.
Get rid of the blockage.
How?
Get rid of the blockage.
Get rid of the blockage.
God damn it. My mind is screaming, echoing the incantation that's pulsing in the back part of the blockage. I plug my ears with my fingers, frantically trying to dull the incessant noise. The chant drones on, and I feel completely useless. When I remove my fingers from my ears, I see they're covered in a thick, moist black goo. What the fuck?
Get rid of the blockage.
I run to the bathroom, rip open the medicine cabinet, and grab the Q-tips. One in each hand, I drive them into my ears. No sooner do they make contact inside and I twist them than a flood of the same black ear snot starts to dribble out. I root around for some more, and then the flow stops. But the sing-song in the back of my head continues. Fine, I say to myself as I wipe myself off and think. Longer. I grab two pens from in front of the typewriter and try the same trick as with the Q-tips. I can feel the pressure as I force them in, coughing and gagging all the while. Peter! I manage to extrude a little more of the blockage, but it's still there. I'm at a loss, covered in snot, and the chanting continues. The blockage is still there, and I crumple with depression. Get rid of the blockage. Get rid of the blockage. Get rid of the blockage. I hear the drone as I lay on the floor for what seems like hours, miserable and ready to die with a head full of crap. Then I stir, and with the sing-song buzzing still, I go to the basement. Each step is terrible. I flick on the light, walk over to the tool chest, and then I grab it. The drill. Yeah. I plug it in, I test it. It whirs with an almost expectant squeal. I fumble a moment looking for the bits, but they're all there, all shining and sharp and ready to do some sinister work. I grab the longest bit with the thickest gauge. The drone continues. The drill bites the bit in place and I test it again. It's go time. I mean, how else can I get rid of the blockage? And the voice. I raise the drill up and hover it next to my right ear. The sound is almost loud enough to drown out the monotony echoing in my skull, but not quite. I bear down on the trigger and slowly inch the spinning steel to my ear. I can feel the air it's moving as it spins. It's closer. The chant is getting louder, faster. But this is it. And that's when it hits. Not only the spinning metal grazing my inner ear, but an idea. I drop the drill and I can feel the blockage seep away back into the ether of my brain. And the incessant sing-song dies down with a whisper like a fart in the wind. I wipe myself off, walk back to my pens and my typewriter, sit down, crack my knuckles, and get to work.
After a long week of singing to orphans, sometimes the old Chris Keeper likes to come down into the wine cellar of the vault of startling monster horror tales of terror and tipple a few tippers. Oh, shit. Well, anyway, this next story's from the new guy, but it's a classic. How can you tell it is a classic? It's got a British voice in it. Yes, he somehow wrangled Sir Andrew Leyland to do the gravitas part of this horror classic. Does somebody want to hold my hair? I think I'm going to throw up. It's only one hair.
The Cask of Amontillado by Edgar Allan Poe. The thousand injuries of Fortunato I had borne as best I could, but when he ventured upon insult, I vowed revenge. You, who so well know the nature of my soul, will not suppose, however, that gave utterance to a threat. At length I would be avenged. This was a point definitely settled, but the very definitiveness of which it was resolved precluded the idea of risk. I must not only punish, but punish with impunity. A wrong is unredressed when retribution overtakes its redresser. It is equally unredressed when the avenger fails to make himself felt as such to him who has done the wrong. It must be understood that neither by word nor deed had I given Fortunato cause to doubt my goodwill. I continued, as was my end, to smile in his face, and he did not perceive that my despile was now at the thought of his immolation. He had a weak point, this Fortunato. Although in other regards he was a man to be respected and even feared, He prided himself on his connoisseurship in wine. Few Italians have the virtuoso spirit. For the most part, their enthusiasm is adopted to suit the time and opportunity, to practice imposture upon the British and Austrian millionaires. In painting and gemmery, Fortunato, like his countrymen, was a quack. But in matter of old wines, he was sincere. In this respect, I did not differ from him materially. I was skillful in the Italian vintages myself, and brought largely whenever I could. It was about dusk one evening, during the supreme madness of the carnival season, that I encountered my friend. He accosted me with excessive warmth, for he had been drinking much. The man wore motley. He had on a tight-fitting, party-striped dress, and his head was surmounted by the conical cap and bells. I was so pleased to see him that I thought I should never have done wringing his hand. I said to him, "My dear Fortunato, you are luckily met. How remarkably well you are looking today. But I have received a pipe of what passes for Amontillado, and I have my doubts."
"How? Amontillado? A pipe? Impossible. And in the middle of the carnival?"
"I have my doubts, and I was silly enough to pay the full Amontillado price without consulting you on the matter. You were not to be found, and I was fearful of losing a bargain."
"Amontillado?"
"I have my doubts."
"Amontillado?"
"And I must satisfy them."
"Amontillado?"
"As you are engaged, I am on my way to meet Lucchesi. If anyone has a critical turn, it is he. He will tell me..."
"Lucchesi cannot tell Amontillado from sherry."
"And yet some fools will have it that his taste is a match for your own."
"Come, let us go."
"Whither?"
"To your vaults."
My friend, no. I will not impose on your good nature. I perceive you have an engagement. Lucchesi..."
"I have no engagement. Come."
My friend, no. It's not the engagement, but the severe cold which I perceive you are afflicted. The vaults are insufferably damp. They are encrusted with nitre."
"Let us go, nevertheless. The cold is merely nothing. Amontillado! You have been imposed upon. And as for Lucchesi, he cannot distinguish sherry from Amontillado."
Thus speaking, Fortunato possessed himself of my arm, and putting on a mask of black silk and drawing a reliquaire around my person, I suffered him to hurry me to my palazzo. There were no attendants at my home. They had absconded to make merry in honor of the time. I had told them I should not return until the morning, and had given them explicit orders not to stir from the house. These orders were sufficient, I well knew, to ensure their immediate disappearance, one and all, as soon as my back was turned. I took from the sconces two flambeaux, and giving one to Fortunato, bowed him through the several suites of rooms to the archway that led to the vaults. I passed down a long and winding staircase, requesting him to be cautious as he followed. We came at a length to the foot of the descent, and stood together upon the damp ground of the catacombs of the Montresors. My gait of my friend was unsteady, and the bells upon his cap jingled as he strode.
"The pipe!"
"It is further on, but observe the white webwork which gleams from these cavern walls." He turned towards me, and looked into my eyes with two filmy orbs that distilled the room of intoxication.
"Nitre?"
"Nitre," I replied. "How long have you had that cough?" My poor friend found it impossible to reply for many minutes.
"It is nothing,"
he said at last. "Come," said I with decision, "we will go back. Your health is precious. You are rich, respected, admired, beloved. You are happy as once I was. You are a man to be missed. For me it is no matter. We will go back. You will be ill, and I cannot be responsible. Besides, there is Lucchesi."
"Enough! The coughs are mere nothing. It will not kill me. I shall not die of a cough."
"True. True. And indeed, I had no intention of alarming you unnecessarily. But you should use all proper caution. A draught of this medic will defend us from the damps." Here I knocked off the neck of a bottle, which I drew from a long row of its fellows that lay upon the mould. "Drink," I said, presenting him with the wine. He raised it to his lips with a leer. He paused and nodded to me familiarly, while his bells jingled.
"I drink to the buried that repose around us."
"And I to your long life." He again took my arm, and we proceeded.
"These vaults are extensive."
"The Montresors were a great and numerous family."
"I forget your arms.
a huge human foot to all, in a field azure. The foot crushes a serpent rampant whose fangs are embedded in the heel.
And the motto?
Nemo me impune lecessit.
Good.
The wine sparkled in his eyes and the bells jingled. My own fancy grew warm with the medic. We had passed through long walls of piled skeletons, with cast and puncheons intermingling, into the innermost recesses of the catacombs. I paused again, and this time I made bold to seize Fortunato by an arm above the elbow. The nitre, see, it increases. It hangs like a moss on the vaults. We are below the river's bed. The drops of moisture trickle among the bones. Come, we will go back ere it is too late. Your cough.
It is nothing. Let us go on. But first, another draught of the Medoc.
I broke and reached him a flagon of de Grave. He emptied it in a breath. His eyes flashed with fierce light, and laughed and threw the bottle upwards in a gesticulation I did not understand. I looked at him in surprise. He repeated the movement, a grotesque one.
You do not comprehend?
Not I.
Then you are not of the Brotherhood.
How?
You are not of the Masons.
Yes, I said. Yes.
You? Impossible. A Mason?
A Mason.
A sign? A sign?
It is this, I answered, producing from beneath the folds of my reliquaire a trowel.
You jest,
he exclaimed, recoiling a few paces.
But let us proceed to the Amontillado.
Be it so, I said, replacing the tool beneath my cloak, and again offering him my arm. He leaned upon it heavily. We continued our route in search of the Amontillado. We passed through a range of low arches, descended, passed on, and descended again, arrived at a deep crypt in which the foulness of the air caused our flambeau rather to glow than flame. At the most remote end of the crypt, there appeared another less spacious. Its walls had been lined with human remains, piled to the vault overhead, in the fashion of those great catacombs of Paris. Three sides of this interior crypt were still ornamented in this manner. From the fourth side, the bones had been thrown down, and lay promiscuously upon the earth, forming at one point a mound of some size. Within the wall, thus exposed by the displacing of the bones, we perceived a still interior crypt or recess, in depth about 4 feet, in width 3, in height 6 or 7. It seemed to have been constructed for no especial use within itself, but formed merely the interval between the two colossal supports of the roof of the catacombs, and was backed by one of their circumscribing walls of solid granite. It was in vain that Fortunato, uplifting his dull torch, endeavored to pry into the depth of that recess. Its termination, the feeble light, did not enable us to see. Proceed. Herein is the Amontillado. As for Lucchesi...
He is an ignoramus,
interrupted my friend as he stepped unsteadily forward, while I followed immediately at his heels. In niche, and finding an instant he had reached the extremity of the niche, and finding his progress arrested by the rock, stood stupidly bewildered. A moment more and I had fettered him to the granite. In its surface were two iron staples, distant from each other about 2 feet, horizontally. From one of these depended a short chain, from the other a padlock. Throwing the links around his waist, it was but the work of a few seconds to secure it. He was too much astounded to resist. Withdrawing the key, I stepped back from the recess. Pass your hand over the wall. You cannot help feeling the nitre. Indeed, it is too damp. Once more, let me implore you to return. No? Then I must positively leave you, but I must first render you all the little attentions in my power.
The Amontillado!
Ejaculated my friend, not yet recovered from his astonishment. True, I replied. The Amontillado. As I said these words, I busied myself among the pile of bones which I have before never spoken. Throwing them aside, I soon uncovered a quantity of building stone and mortar. With these materials, and with the aid of my trowel, I began vigorously to wall up the entrance of the niche. I had scarcely laid the first tier of masonry when I discovered that the intoxication of Fortunato had in great measure worn off. The earliest indication I had of this was a low moaning cry from the depth of the recess. It was not the cry of a drunken man. There was then a long and obstinate silence. I laid the second tier, and the third, and the fourth. And then I heard the furious vibrations of the chain. The noise lasted for several minutes, during which that I might hearken to hear it with more satisfaction. I ceased my labors and sat down upon the bones. When at last the clanking subsided, I resumed the trowel, and finished without interruption the fifth, the sixth, and the seventh tier. The wall was now upon a level with my breast. I again paused, and holding the flambeau over the masonwork, threw a few feeble rays upon the figure within. A succession of loud and shrill screams, bursting suddenly from the throat of the chain form, seemed to thrust me violently back. For a brief moment I hesitated. I trembled. Unsheathing my rapier, I began to grope with it about the recess. But the thought of an instant reassured me. I placed my hand upon the solid fabric of the catacombs and felt satisfied. I reapproached the wall. I replied to the yells of who clamored. I re-echoed. I aided. I surpassed them in volume and in strength. I did this, and the clamor grew still. It was now midnight, and my task was drawing to a close. I had completed the eighth, the ninth, and the tenth tier. I had finished a portion of the last and the 11th. There remained but a single stone to be fitted and plastered in. I struggled with its weight. I placed it partially in its destined position. But now there came out from the niche a low laugh that erected the hairs upon my head. It was succeeded by a sad voice, which I had difficulty in recognizing as that of the noble Fortunato. The voice said,
A very good joke indeed, and an excellent jest. We will have many a rich laugh about it at the Palazzo, over our wine.
the Amontillado.
Yes, the Amontillado. But it is not getting late. Will not they be waiting for us at the Palazzo, the Lady Fortunato and the rest? Let us be gone.
Yes, let us be gone.
For the love of God, Montressa!
Yes, for the love of God. But to those words I hearkened in vain for a reply. I grew impatient. I called aloud. Fortunato! No answer. I called again. Fortunato! No answer still. I thrust the torch through the remaining aperture and let it fall within. There came forth in return only a jingling of the bells. My heart grew sick. It was the dampness of the catacombs that made it so. I hastened to make an end to my labor. I forced the last stone into its position. I plastered it up. Against the new masonry, I re-erected the old rampart of bones. For the half of a century, no mortal has disturbed them. In pace, requiescant.
Well, that was kind of unfortunato. Oh, Jesus. Anyway, moving on. We've got another creepy story. I know it's creepy, because I'm a creep and I wrote it. Yes, there's a moral to this story. Every famous person will tell you that celebrity eats them alive. But what if the celebrities eat you alive? Well, that's a kind of stupid tagline.
A trip to the zoo. Hunter McClintock was in a bar drinking shitty local homebrew and waiting for someone to recognize him and buy him some of the shittier hard stuff. He was thinking about his current job in relation to before. Before, people had optimally got a job in their chosen profession. Or they were like him. First he was Hank McIntyre, pizza delivery boy, and then Hank the barback, and then Hank the bouncer. Hank the security guard quickly morphed into Hank the bail bond collector, and then everything went crazy. That's when that bounty hunter in Hawaii got on TV, and before you knew it, Hank McIntyre was Hunter McClintock, bounty hunter, star of the cut-rate copycat reality show. The show ran a couple of seasons and was slated for at least one more when Hunter's profession unexpectedly changed. One morning he woke up to the sound of low moans coming from his backyard. He wandered out to find his wife sprawled naked on the lawn, her arms strewn out and her head thrown back. She was surrounded by the three gardeners who were on their hands and knees, pawing and nuzzling at her. He didn't know if it was rape or adultery until he got closer and realized it was neither. They were eating her alive. That's when Hunter got handed the same job as every other living person on Earth. Find food and stay alive. He kept that job for 5 years. That's how long it took to beat back the 75% of the population who had gone geek. 5 years later, humanity was hanging in there at an estimated 5% of the population from pre-geek days. That lady doctor in the Ozarks had come up with a vaccine that would keep you from turning if you died, but a geek bite would still turn you. The living dead were a rare sight these days and were very manageable because they were never in groups, and that's where they got dangerous. Hunter lived in LA, one of the three population centers in the US, and they had limited electricity, several kinds of money, and a nightlife. Civilization. No internet, no phone, no TV, but they had a newspaper and something resembling a rudimentary police force. Life was pretty cozy for Hunter. People still remembered him from the TV days. He was hard to miss. A People magazine critic had described him as a combination of Axl Rose, Hulk Hogan, and a big bag of crystal meth. And he purposely maintained this look because the recognition paid off reliably in booze and pussy. When they asked him if he was still a bounty hunter, he would answer, "Sort of. I'm a zookeeper." 3 years ago, when the big mess had just gotten settled down, Hunter had found himself a nice little spread in the hills. Easy to defend and with a wood-fired hot tub. One morning, he awoke to hear familiar moans outside his bedroom window. This time he emerged from his house with a pump shotgun and faced one lone shambling geek. He leveled the gun at its head, but stopped and felt his jaw drop. It was the goddamn Terminator! The goddamn Governator! No doubt it was him! The chunk taken out of his face made Hunter even more certain of who he was looking at. There was no hint of the familiar Austrian accent in the moans and gurgles it expelled as it slow motion flailed towards Hunter. There was no way he was just gonna blast its head off. He couldn't bring himself to do it. Even though it was sort of tempting to spout off a catchphrase in broken English before dispatching the former action hero. He ended up throwing a sack over his head, tying him up, and stashing him in the basement until he figured out what he wanted to do with him. But he stunk the whole goddamn house up. The rotten smell drifted through the vents and soaked into the walls, and even though he was wrapped up and tied like a mummy, he could still put up a racket. He had to go somewhere else, and Hunter had an idea. His drinking buddy Pete ran the LA Zoo, or what was left of it. Pete had been a low-rung elephant shit shoveler, but now he ran the entire zoo owing to the fact that he was the only one left. He had managed to keep a small portion of the animals alive for a while, but many had escaped, starved, or been poached for food. He had a whole bunch of empty cages, and surely Arnie could hang out in one of them for a while. He packed his celebrity guest in the back of his SUV with the motor taken out, hitched up his horses, and headed to the zoo in the middle of the night. It would be more subtle, and that was mostly when Pete was up and around anyway. He got to the gate and buzzed the intercom. Pete answered immediately.
"Yeah."
"Hey Pete, it's Hunter. I got a bottle and a new friend," Hunter said, and then leaned into the mesh square and did a terrible impersonation.
"Hey Pete, it's me, Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'm back. Come on, Pete, I got some German beer."
Yeah, I'll be right out. Jesus."
When Pete showed up and saw Hunter standing there with his prize, secured with a collar attached to a pole, his face lit up.
"Is that really who I think it is?"
So, Arnold found a new home in a former monkey cage with a plexiglass wall. Pete and Hunter took out the ropes and the tire swing, painted the walls to look like an iron foundry, and threw in a bunch of pipes for good measure. The hardest part had been getting Geek Arnie into his costume, but they'd got it done, and when they'd finished stapling on the sunglasses, the diorama was complete. Once word caught on, the new display was a big hit. When the crowd started to wane, they would set up a set of one of Arnie's other movies, and the crowds would swell again. After a particularly hellish 14 hours of getting the former governor into his Mr. Freeze outfit, Hunter decided to see if he could scare up some new blood for the zoo, and thus, his new profession was born. At first he thought it was a lost cause. There weren't really many geeks left wandering around, and how many of them could possibly be celebrities? It turned out there were actually plenty of geeks to be found, if you were looking for them, which nobody was. With a little detective work, you could easily find Ben Affleck's house, and who knows who you might find there? Well, it turns out it's zombie Ben Affleck, and he's been tangled up in the neighbor's swing set for the last few months, apparently. As the zoo got more and more profitable, word got out that cold Cali cash would be paid for celebrities, and what do you know? Someone just happened to have geek Cheech Marin locked up in the garage eating rats. There was a strange phenomenon that Hunter had experienced himself and observed in others, where there was a reluctance to pulp the brain of a famous person, even if it was some star that they absolutely hated. It wasn't simply that they recognized that person. Almost everybody had been in a situation where they had to put down someone familiar, and even often someone they loved. It was the aura of celebrity, he thought, that stopped them from pulling the trigger or swinging the shovel. This was the standard story. The undead Tyra Banks would wander into the backyard barbecue. Dad and Junior would wrangle her and toss her in the shed, or quite often an empty pool. The neighbors would come over, pictures would get taken, but soon it would become really apparent that old Tyra was kind of a liability. But nobody could bring themselves to polish her off. That's when they would approach Hunter, or often he found them. In a year, the zoo had a stable of 57 celebrities of all types, actors, musicians, politicians, models, and even reality stars. In 2 years, they had over 100, and were reaching the point where they were becoming more picky in their celebrity acquisitions. Maintenance was particularly difficult. They had discovered that cosmetic surgery during life made for problems after death, as in their faces had a habit of coming apart at the seams or simply sliding off. There were many hours of stitching and makeup application to be done each day to make sure that everyone was recognizable. Most dreaded of all was the yearly formaldehyde dunk. That came up after Woody Allen had snapped in two one day. Speaking of formaldehyde, it kind of reminded Hunter of the tepid booze he was currently drinking. All in all, he thought, it was an honest living, and in many ways, he was better off now than before the world ate itself. He was well-fed, three-quarters drunk, and odds were probably even that he would get laid tonight, so life was good. He saw the bouncer walk in and lean into the bartender. They glanced over at Hunter, and the bouncer headed towards him while throwing a "watch this" look over his shoulder at the bartender. He pulled up a chair. "Hey, Hunter, you're gonna shit your pants. There's somebody famous outside who wants to meet you. And they're alive! Isn't that ironic?" Hunter frowned. "Yeah, I guess. Are they pissed at me?" The bouncer laughed. "Hell no, they didn't ask for you by name, dude. He's looking to find some girls, and he wants some nice girls, so I was gonna send them to you. You're gonna shit your pants, dude." "Is he paying?" Hunter asked. "Hell, I imagine he is. He gave me 50 in CCs just to ask around." "Well, send him in," Hunter laughed and looked toward the door. The bouncer jogged over and motioned for someone to come in. And in he walked, and damned if it wasn't him in the flesh. He grinned a toothy grin and walked toward the zookeeper with his hand outstretched. Hunter stood up, rocking the table and spilling his drink. He felt his face flush and stuck out his hand and actually began to shake hands with him. He blurted out, It's a great pleasure to meet you, sir, Mr. Seinfeld. And then he spoke. "Hunter McClintock, bounty hunter, I presume. Glad to meet you. Call me Jerry." A wave of dissonance superimposed itself on Hunter's brain. The voice and the face did not match. Something had happened to Jerry Seinfeld's voice. It was now a rich baritone. That's when he saw the bouncer laughing his ass off. "You're not Jerry Seinfeld, are you?" said Hunter, slightly pissed and sorely disappointed. "No, man, my name's Steve, but you can call me Jerry Seinfeld if you want. Everybody else does." Steve was a trucker, at least what was passing as a trucker those days. He had a converted hay wagon pulled by horses, and he had just dropped off a load of oranges. He wasn't Jerry Seinfeld, but he did have a wallet full of CCs and he was looking to buy drinks and women. Hunter was also feeling a little better because he was once again the biggest star in the club. At least he was the second Steve opened his mouth. After a couple more drinks, Hunter was ready to get moving. He and Steve had a good buzz on and he was ready to get to the real action of the night. "So, Jerry," he said, "what are you thinking about in the lady department? Are we talking street meet or do you want to go somewhere we can spread out?"
"I want to go somewhere where there's a bar and preferably some music and some kind of choice because I don't know what I want, but I'll know when I see it."
He laughed like a donkey, surprisingly high-pitched for such a deep speaking voice. "So I know this one place," said Hunter, "has a jukebox and a lot of ladies to pick from if you don't mind leading toward the Asian side." Steve grinned a big toothy grin. "Sounds perfect. Is it close?"
"Yeah, man, it's close. It's like a block from the zoo, which is right over there."
"The zoo," said Steve, his eyes lighting up.
"I heard about that zoo. Is it true they got Oprah fighting Jerry Springer?"
Hunter laughed. "We don't have gladiatorial matches, but we do have simulated exhibitions. We do have Oprah, though, but the most exciting thing she does is eat rats." Steve stopped walking and looked at him.
"You say we. Does that mean you work at the zoo?"
Hunter smiled. "I'm a zookeeper now. Want to stop by on the way? I got the keys and we could have a couple more drinks there with my buddy Pete. He might even have a few women around, so there's an outside chance of one-stop shopping."
Steve was almost giddy. "Are you kidding? Really?
Come on, Jerry. I'll give you the after-hours tour." In a couple minutes, they were at the gate. Hunter hit the intercom.
"Pete, wake up. I got company."
Pete's voice came through the grate. He sounded annoyed and half drunk.
"Jesus Christ, I'm watching movies."
"Come on, Pete.
I brought the world's greatest comedian." He leaned toward the grate and did his worst.
"Hey, Pete, what is it with these celebrity zombies? I mean, who are they fooling?"
"That's the shittiest George Carlin impression I've ever heard."
When they met up with Pete, Hunter savored the look on Pete's face when he first laid eyes on Steve and cracked up when the Mr. Ed voice came out of Jerry Seinfeld's mouth. Before too long, they were passing around a bottle and walking through the dioramas of revived celebrities, randomly turning on lights. In one cage, Keith Olbermann sat at a desk with an old-fashioned radio microphone, while across from him, zombie Bill O'Reilly sat with a similar setup. They groggily rocked back and forth in their seats, chained in place.
"Watch this," said Pete.
"We crammed earbuds in their ears." He flipped a switch and the corpses sprung to life, flailing and slashing their arms at each other, enraged. Pete laughed.
"It's a Limp Bizkit song. It drives them batshit."
He flipped the switch off and the two figures slowly began to calm down. There was Willard Scott, set up in front of a weather chart, pointer stick attached to his hand with wire. Here were Cheech and Chong, tied down to an old couch in front of a TV show and cartoons. Dry ice smoke drifted out of a bong attached to the table and plastic pot plants poked out of the planters. Between them was a bowl marked Munchies, filled with old Doritos. A cockroach emerged from the bowl and geek Tommy Chong snatched it up and slowly and deliberately put it in his mouth. Hunter laughed. "We haven't figured out how to get him to smoke yet." Steve was having the time of his life.
"This is the coolest thing I have ever seen."
Hunter looked at Pete and smiled. "We need to take him to the stables and show him you-know-who." They led him across the grounds to a nondescript stable that used to house horses, but now held all the zombies who were not on display. They came up to a stall, and a figure inside rose and shambled forward, his hair disheveled. Hunter turned on the light.
"Kramer!" shouted Steve. "Why isn't he out there?"
"Well," said Hunter, "we don't know what to do with him. Or her." He threw the light switch in the next stall. Steve goggled.
"Elaine!"
Then a mosquito stung him in the neck. He tried to slap it away, but his arm only moved about an inch, and his legs felt rubbery. Hunter grabbed his arm.
"Whoa, Jerry, let me help you there."
He looked down at Hunter's other hand, which held a comically large syringe. Somehow, Pete had slipped up behind him and pulled Steve's hands behind his back and tightened a zip tie around them. Pete leaned up to Steve and said,
"Don't worry, Jerry, just kiss your girlfriend and the next thing you know, you'll be waking up dead."
His breath smelled like formaldehyde. He shoved Steve's head into the stall, and Zombie Elaine sauntered over and bit a good-sized chunk out of his neck. The recreation of the Seinfeld set was pretty impressive. Zombie Jerry and Zombie Elaine sat on a couch in the middle of the living room watching a TV. The door flew open and in stumbled Geek Kramer, shoved forward by a spring-driven mechanism. He ambled over to the refrigerator and opened it. Inside was a fish tank full of mice, and he started to lazily feed. The man in the crowd looked at his friend. "This sucks. There's no George. Let's go to the Adam Sandler dunking booth."
And now we bring you to the final terror of tonight's show, by Luke Giaconetti. This is a classic horror story about a boy and his pot. Ah, who writes this shit? Ponderous. Fucking ponderous.
The Summoning Pot. The walls of the shed were dry and more than a little dusty, gleaming a dull yellow in the glow of the single overhead bulb in the dead center of the pitched roof. In spots, peeking through the gaps from the outside, was the sepia-tinged orange of the just-ignited mercury lamp mixing with the dimming sunlight of dusk. The whole scene had a certain otherworldliness to it, which suited Franklin just fine. Otherworldly was what he was shooting for tonight. Franklin's forehead and cheeks were flushed red, with that gassed feeling one gets right before breaking out in a sweat, but not quite all the way. Having lugged the stockpot from the house over to the outside faucet, and then from there over to the shed, was about the limit of Franklin's physical exertion levels for one day. He preferred to let his fingers do his work for him on the computer, or let his tongue get a workout marveling those around him with his wit. Physical labor is for the weak-minded, Franklin thought, and clearly he was not one of those deemed weak-minded if his Genius at Work t-shirt and Burn Your TV bumper sticker were any indication. With one last grunt of effort, Franklin hoisted the stockpot onto the makeshift table formed from two sheets of shelving board and two sawhorses he had borrowed from his dad's garage. The water sloshed around and ran over the lip, but not enough to cause any concern. The amount of water was not super important. At least, the book didn't say that it was, and that was enough of a reassurance to Franklin to not worry about it. The book. That was a key to all of this. Books were often keys, Franklin thought. A mixed metaphor, certainly, but an apt one. As a young man, books were the keys Franklin used to escape from his intolerable existence, surrounded by the weak-minded yokel morons of this town. Books were a sign of intelligence and superiority in a world of mediocrity and severely lowered expectations. Franklin never understood the fascination of the people of this town with the meathead jocks who could throw a ball really well, or the prissy, stuck-up rich bitches who had daddy pay for their every whim. What was the big deal? What made those accomplishments special? He was much smarter than those idiots, clearly. Why didn't he get the accolades? Even the teachers at school were in on the whole thing, reliving their long bygone glory days through the lives of the meatheads and the rich bitches whom they envied so much. Franklin could have gone to any college in the country if not for those conniving SOBs at the high school who gave him all those lousy grades on tests. All because he couldn't run or jump or throw some stupid ball and his parents weren't rich and he didn't get handed everything on a silver platter all the damn time. So Franklin contented himself with his books and decided that if the world as he knew it was aligned against him and conspired to keep him stuck in this podunk hellhole, at least he'd learn everything he could about how to escape from it and maybe show those stuck-up pricks a little something at the same time. Franklin vividly remembered the first time he had thought about this particular course of action. He'd gone down to the Dragon's Cave, the comic shop and game store two towns over up 17, out by the shoe depot in the spot where the Whataburger used to be before it closed. He was hunting down some back issues of Legion of Superheroes he needed, and spent 45 minutes perusing the stacks like an art dealer looking over a gallery opening. If comics weren't art, Franklin thought, then nothing is. Clearly. After finding a handful of issues to fill in holes on his punch list, Franklin wandered over to the back side of the store, which was where the miniatures gamers set up shop and essentially held court most nights and every weekend. There was a minor ruckus going down, with a crowd of half a dozen folks, including the owner, crowded around a table where two guys Franklin didn't recognize were playing something. Not that Franklin really paid much attention to people, but these guys didn't have the intellectual look of comics readers. Nah, these were straight-up dice monkeys. Still, the general commotion piqued Franklin's interest. He made his way over to the games table slowly, examining every shelf and sales table between he and it, clearly demonstrating to anyone who would be paying attention his clear disinterest. Sidling up close to the crowd, Franklin craned his neck and peered down at the game board. The table itself was topped with a sheet of thick plywood, painted a forest green. Sculpted hills and rocky outcroppings dotted the plywood, along with plastic modeling trees, and a big piece of blue construction paper cut in a rough oval to represent a lake. One player's forces consisted of men mounted on horseback, wearing bright liveries like Arthurian knights. The other player's models were much stranger, blue and pink and purple things, with big teeth and mangled and twisted limbs. There were topless, violet-skinned babes with crab claws for hands, and standing above them all a blood-red, horn-headed, bat-winged beast which looked ready to eat anything in its path. Franklin was no gamer, but he was impressed with what he saw. The conversation of the game began to filter up to him. "All right," said the player controlling the monsters, napping up tiny dice with the precision of a carrion bird picking at its roadkill lunch. "Let's take the test." A tiny clattering of dice rolling on the table, followed by some various woos from the assemblage. 7, yes! All right, baby, more demons on the table! As the player began to move more miniatures onto the table, a strange thought interjected itself into Franklin's frontal lobe and asserted itself quite boldly. Demons. Franklin watched for a few more minutes and then headed out of the store, his mind unable to let go of the simple concept of demons and the demonic. He drove back down 17 on autopilot, his mind becoming mazed in thought as he did. Demons, and the summoning of them. An archaic idea, surely. But really, was it all that archaic? Wasn't the occult all based in some reality at some point? Franklin mused over the idea. Makes sense that the occult must exist on a certain level, right? It seems arrogant to think that humans know everything that is to be known about both the living and the dead, and even beyond that. It's just like extraterrestrials, he reasoned. The absence of proof is not proof of absence, just proof that you have not found anything yet. Witchcraft was real, of that he was sure. Down here in the Low Country, there were plenty of stories of ghosts and hauntings and the like dating back to the colonial days. Back in town, there was that old plantation house which everyone said was haunted. Something or other estate or something. The Widow House was what the locals called it, anyway. If witchcraft and ghosts could be generally accepted, then demons did not seem like much of a stretch. Demons were not childish crap like angels or stuff like that. That was for little kids and did not have any basis in rational thought. Franklin did not believe in God, but he certainly believed in evil. Evil was demonstrable in the world. The presence of God was not. That night, Franklin left his Legion comics in the car and went straight into his room over the garage. He started out where all quests begin, Google. He tried different combinations of keywords, finding lots of stuff about the fictionally demonic, including a rather amusing scan of an illustrated religious tract, but not a lot on the real thing. His mother came by at some point, asking him to come down to dinner. His grunted decline, followed by a sharper retort when she pressed the issue, was enough for her to get the message and retreat. A little after midnight, Adult Swim had started those weird 15-minute shows, so it had to be after midnight, Franklin found a forum called The Pit. The description seemed encouraging. A forum for those who believe in the true darkness. Sounded good. He poked around a few of the sub-forums. There were lots of pictures of babes of all shapes and sizes, though pretty universally with multicolored hair and lots of piercings and tattoos, typically wearing black or purple, and occasionally black and purple, panties and not much else, though Franklin did mutter several times that the babes shouldn't have bothered covering their chests if they were showing that much already. One forum had poorly written fan fiction, and another showcased amateur artwork. Grumbling, he moved to close the tab in his browser when he noticed a forum all the way at the bottom of the page. Darkness, IRL. Franklin cocked his right eyebrow and clicked through. There were not many threads, only one page worth. And all of the threads seemed to be started by the same author, one Darkness Lover. He flicked on the profile button and was greeted with the rounded face of a babe, with jet black hair streaked with neon green stripes, which tumbled down on either side of her black glasses. Her age was hidden, as was her location. Interests were, in order, darkness, the demonic, sex, witchcraft, voodoo, and sex with demons, followed by a smiley face. Intriguing, Franklin thought. He looked over the rest of her profile, at the very least hoping to see a picture of her in sexy underwear. He clicked through to her albums page and was rewarded with a series of shots of Darkness Lover posing for her webcam in various states of undress. She was a big girl, but that suited Franklin just fine. The captions on the pictures were teasing, such as a rear shot showing the word Wicked emblazoned in blood red on black boy shorts, with the note, "Anyone want to see just how wicked?" Franklin leaned back in his chair and smiled to himself, right-clicking and saving as he did. Save these for later, he thought, but time to focus. He jumped back to the form after one last long look at Darkness Lover's delicious ass. Franklin's eyes bulged a little bit when he read the title of the first thread that she had posted, Summoning Fac. He clicked immediately. The thread was a narrative of Darkness Lover's attempts to summon demons and the research she had done in pursuit of this goal. He read the thread, soon discovering that only Darkness Lover had posted on the thread, updating every few days as she made new discoveries or had fresh setbacks. Eventually, she started talking about a book she had found in an antique bookshop outside of Shreveport. That gives away her location, Franklin had mused. How far was Louisiana by car? The book was entirely in Latin and was moldering to the point of falling apart, but the title included the word Demonica, so she had bought it immediately. Details followed. Darkness Lover had carefully studied the book and translated a lot of it from the Latin. It wasn't perfect, she advised, because she was using online translators rather than taking it to the university for a language professor to look at. She didn't want anyone to know what she was doing. Franklin nodded in silent approval of her decision. It became clear after a few more of her updates that this Demonica book, the rest of the title having been completely lost off the cover and not mentioned inside, was a manual for the exorcism of demons and spirits from the physical world. But it also contained general principles on exactly the opposite, the idea being that exorcists could look for these signs of trouble beforehand and stop them early. Or something like that, anyway. She was going to be trying them herself when she got back from some vague road trip or something which he was going on. Franklin's pulse raced. This is what he was looking for. Summoning demons. He wasn't sure why he suddenly wanted this so much. He hadn't thought about the occult much before this. Hell, he hadn't even thought of the old widow house before he ran into that guy at the used bookstore, who was house-sitting it or something. The whole thing was strange. Why had he suddenly started down this line of thought? Didn't matter. He'd found what he was looking for and a smoking hot babe at the same time. He started blowing all of Darkness Lover's posts into a text file and saved them, then dashed off a personal message to her thanking her for her help and praising how gorgeous she was. Oh, and by the way, he was in South Carolina, so he was a southerner like her, and how he would love to hear back from her and they could talk about whatever. Franklin had a good feeling about her. The next day was Sunday. Franklin stayed in his room most of the day, avoiding his parents. This was not as hard as one might think, mostly because they had learned to give him his space. He didn't hate his parents, exactly, but they certainly did not understand him. They were so ordinary, not gifted with intellect like he was. There was nothing for them to talk about, which is why he didn't eat his mother's cooking or come to meals or anything. It took them a while to figure it out, but eventually his parents had stopped bothering him and just left him to his thoughts. It was getting on towards supper time. Beef stew tonight, Franklin wondered? Or maybe lentils? When he heard the garage door open and his parents head out in the Buick. Franklin looked down at his watch. 5:13. He glanced out the window. Clear. Decent amount of sunlight left. Looks good to me. Time to get down to business. Franklin had everything he needed in the shed. He had printed out the appropriate sections of the Demonica book. He had the stockpot filled with water. The book had called for a cauldron, but this was the best he could do. And he had gathered the herbs and oil which the book had detailed. He had dressed in the black robes he had picked up a few years ago on the internet. The fact that there was a website which did wholesale sales on academic and judicial robes had tickled Franklin too much to not buy one. Pulling the shed door closed behind him, he moved the lawnmower to the other side to give himself room to work and began the ceremony. He looked down at the still waters of the pot. He saw himself staring back and smiled out the side of his mouth. He picked up the first herb, the garlic. He held it over the water, then dropped it in with a plop and began the incantation. It wasn't Latin, but it was close. Darkness Lover had transcribed it phonetically. Next came the flaxseed, then the turmeric, and milk thistle, each with their own little incantation in the not-Latin. After this, the oil was added. Franklin hoped that canola oil would be all right, as the translation was not really specific. He took a broomstick off the peg rack and stirred the concoction, all the while intoning the words slowly and carefully, trying to keep everything in the pot. Franklin looked down again into the swirling mass. He looked more like the beginnings of a soup broth than something that was going to summon beasts from hell. He peered deeply at his own reflection for another second, then blinked. What was that? A tiny green light illumined the bottom of the pot. Franklin squinted and stared. Sure enough, there was the little green light slowly drifting upwards from the bottom of the pot. The broth began to glow faintly as a toothy grin spread across Franklin's face. Holy crap, he thought. It worked. The light grew larger as it floated upwards, and brighter as well. Soon the glow from the pot engulfed Franklin in a dark green blanket. His eyes never left the light. He didn't blink, and unconsciously he was holding his breath, too. Another shape began to form around the light as it floated, a swirl of white and gray, with the light near the top. Vaguely the swirl began to take on a humanoid form, a head, a body, limbs. Details continued to fill in as Franklin watched. Hands, a face, a mouth, with the green light where the eyes would be. The light itself then divided like a cell reproducing, and now the twin green orbs were proper eyes for the whirling phantom. Darkness lover's gonna love this, Franklin thought. But his thought was fleeting, for another one pushed its way into the forefront of his brain. Release me. Franklin squinted again. Huh? He wondered aloud. Again came the voice. Release me. Only you can help me. The synapses began firing in Franklin's brain again. This is it, man. Here we go. How? He half-whispered. Give me your hand, responded the voice. Release me. Franklin stretched his right hand slowly towards the surface of the water. He didn't know why, but the hand was shaking. No matter. I've got this, he thought. Yes. Release me, came the voice once more. He reached closer. His hand broke the surface of the cold water and sent a chill straight down his spine, but he was undeterred. His whole hand was in the water when suddenly he felt ice wrap his fingers and grip him. The whirling phantom had been replaced by a beautiful blonde woman, her blue eyes staring directly at him from under the surface. Her grip was like iron, and her stare never wavered. Thank you, the voice came back, the first of many. Franklin stammered, his brow furrowing as he tested her hand strength and found his own lacking. You're a demon? No, replied the voice. Much, much worse. Franklin's mouth hung agape as he struggled to pull his hand free, but to no avail. Frost lines began to form on the surface of the water, creeping from the edge towards the center, solidifying the broth into ice. Franklin thrashed and pulled, but the woman's grip was unbreakable. The ice touched his skin, searing it with the cold, and then shortly had enveloped his entire hand at the wrist. Franklin could feel his temperature dropping as his efforts became slower and slower. What do you want? Why are you doing this? What do you want from me? I told you, said the voice. You are the first of many who will help me. Indeed, someone like you. Weak, foolish, stupid. You have served your purpose well. The chill spread throughout his body. Franklin's teeth chattered on their own accord, and his legs began to shake. The ice turned cloudy as it began to spread down, engulfing his fingers. Through the tears stinging his eyes, Franklin could still see the woman staring back at him, the green fire back in her eyes once more. Without warning, the ice cracked and shattered outward towards Franklin, scattering itself all over the shed, smacking and nicking Franklin's face and chest as it did. He shielded himself as best he could with his other arm, but his right was still held tightly. He ventured another look into the pot, the broth having returned to its previous liquid state. The woman smiled a small, demure smile, and the voice began, "Thank you again. You have no idea what you have set into motion." 4 rotted hands burst forth from the pot, each grabbing a hold of Franklin by the arm or shoulder. Franklin screamed out over and over and thrashed about as hard as he could, but he couldn't break either arm free from the unholy grip which now had taken a hold of him. The sharp nails of the gripping hands dug into his skin and then began to pull, dragging his face towards the surface of the water. Franklin screamed for all he was worth, gasping in terror and shock as the 4 arms continued their inexorable motion. He was bent over the pot now, both arms under the surface, his face inches above, and the voice told him once more, "Thank you." The water was freezing on his face as he was pulled under. Desperate for air, he began to twist his head left and right, but it was a wasted effort. Down, down, down into the water he went, the arms filling his vision, the woman gone. He thought he might have heard soft laughter as the light got dimmer and dimmer, but his brain had ceased to function properly at that point. His vision went red, and then black, and then there was silence and peace both inside the pot as well as inside the shed. Franklin's parents returned home that night to find their son out. When he did not return the next day or the day after that, their initial worries were clouded by a different feeling, relief. They had tried for so long to get Franklin to strike out on his own, and he was not himself lately at all, that as much as they hated to admit it, getting him out of the house was a victory. They did find it strange that he had left his computer behind, but looking around on it for clues, his father found a message for a young lady in Louisiana, talking about some demon game or comic or something. Maybe that's where Franklin has gone, to meet this online girl. Well, his dad thought he could do a lot worse, I guess. Darkness Lover had been excited to see someone else who shared her enthusiasm. She had sent a message to Franklin on Monday, saying how cool he was for trying the summoning, and that she was going to try it the next day. If this works, we'll totally have to meet up and have some fun, hee hee. Wish me luck, the message ended.
Do you ever find yourself going to Amazon.com and buying some record or movie or some stupid thing that Two True Freaks have been talking about so that you can catch up on it or you've been reminded of it or something? Well, now, how about this? Instead of going to Amazon.com, go to twotruefreaks.libsyn.com and follow our link to Amazon.com. When you do that, if you buy something over at Amazon, we get a little cut out of it, which is awesome because we love money and it won't cost you a thing.
You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today. Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Libsyn is spelled LIBSYN.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com, where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook too. My name is spelled ScottGardner.
You can friend me on Facebook too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Test, test, say duh. Good luck.